Montreal. You're listening to CKUT.
Production Nuit d'Afrique invites you to the gala of the 17th edition of Signor de la Musique du Monde. See you on Tuesday, April 25th at La Tulipe from 8 p.m. onwards. Come out and support your favorite artists to help them win the Signor d'Argent and des Bronzes. Le Signor de la Musique du Monde is a celebration that brings the cultures of the world together. For more information, visit signor.com.
Good day. You're listening to Free City Radio. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Stefan Christoph. This is edition 210. On the broadcast today, I am going to be sharing a conversation that I recorded in Paris, France, with Sébastien Marchal, who is a graphic designer and community activist. Sébastien has been working over the last months to create meaningful design work that speaks to the extreme genocidal actions that have been taking place in Gaza, Palestine. This is part of a broader effort that Sébastien has been working on for many years to highlight struggles for human rights, struggles for justice through design and poster arts. The project is a coalition in a way of designers. It's called Forme de Lutte, and it's a beautiful project. You can find the link for that project, formedelutte.org, within the description of this show. I thought it was important to talk with Sébastien because a lot of the work that he has done to speak about the extreme injustice happening in Palestine was done collectively, done in group settings, sort of collective poster art and protest imagery sessions of artists coming together and creating work. And often these designs were shared on the streets in protests and also pasted up around Paris, and they were shared also globally. For any of those following the imagery of the solidarity movement for Palestinian human rights and for the freedom of all Palestinians, I'm sure that you might recognize some of the work that Sébastien and others in Paris created. I was with Sébastien in Paris, and I thought it would be great to record a conversation with him about his practice and this important role that collective art making plays in social movements. We talked about that in the context of support work for Palestine, but also more broadly, the importance of art creation and collective art creation within activism. So here's my conversation with Sébastien Marchal that I recorded in Paris for Free City Radio. So we're in Belleville, in Paris now, and there's been protests here over the last weeks in solidarity with Palestine.
Yeah.
Against the ongoing bombing of Gaza.
Yeah.
As we're speaking, it's happening. Hopefully it will end soon. But you're a designer that has been connected with social movements and struggles in France. So maybe we could just start by, can you just introduce yourself and say a bit about the initiative that you're doing right now and in which context?
Yeah, so I'm a graphic designer in Paris since, I don't know, 70 years. Before
17 years.
And but before to go into design, I go into politics and activism, and in a way I go through graphic design through the political side, and always today my main work is about politics and social issues and so ever, and cultural issues too. I know less or more the other graphic designer here in France that are also involved into some kind of activism, and so we knew each other since a long time, and more recently 4 years ago during the protest pour les retraites,
it was the movement that was challenging the reforms to retirement. Yes. Sort of pension system.
Yes, under Macron. There was a big movement, and we begin to produce individually some pictures, but soon we choose to launch a call to every other designers, illustrators, and picture creators that want to do some posters and some pictures to help the movement and to diffuse, to distribute during it, and we receive many proposition. We create a website. The people can download the posters and print them if they want. But we also choose a part of them to print as stickers, and we distribute many stickers during the demonstrations, and thousands of tens of thousands stickers on each demonstration. Wow. And after there is the COVID, and there is another step, because we launched another call about the world after, about the idea that we are all close into our house. We can't demonstrate, we can't say anything, but we can create and print some posters and put them on our windows and so ever. And okay. And it was a second step, and there is other steps after, about other issues, about the hospital and the struggle about hospital, about immigrants, and about precarities and so ever. Mm-hmm. And the last, before the and more recently in 2023, there was again a reform about retirement, and by the government of Macron, and we launched another call about this issue, and there were very many big demonstrations. Unfortunately, we don't win, but during all these demonstrations, we receive many thousands of pictures that we diffuse and distribute as stickers, many hundreds of thousands of stickers. Right. And yes, that's the
yeah. So
the,
so.
And so now well, more
before
recently...
Before we get into that, so the visualization of protest culture in Paris and France generally has a long history, going back to 68, and, you know, the visual culture of revolt in France against social injustice has, a long tradition. So, you know... often mainstream institutions?
For sure, there is some transmission about some more older graphic designer and creators, and particularly in the graphic design, in the history of graphic design in France, there is a big collective, a very important collective, whose name is Grapus. And Grapus was created after May 68. They meet together in the Atelier Populaire numéro 2, dans l'École des Arts Déco. And they created Grapus 2 years after. And they create many strong, very strong posters, very, very strong design during 20 years. Not about, on the political side, on the social side, but also on the cultural side. And after Grapus, during the existence of Grapus, there is less or more a generation of graphic designers that pass through Grapus. Ils ont accueilli beaucoup de graphistes de cette génération. And after they created, they split. But one of them, Gérard Paris Clavel, created another collective, Ne Pas Plier, who always exists and always is, which is always activist. And I personally meet Gérard in 2000, so 23 years ago. And my first experience of graphic design and politics, the two together, was through the work of Gérard. And I learned many things by showing him my posters, my research for posters, and listening to his critiques and his tips and so ever. And yes, with Ne Pas Plier and Gérard, I experienced for the first time also to distribute some pictures with many freely during a big protest, and that was something that I always continue to do personally and with other graphic designers more younger since this experience. And yes, and that's why also Forme des Luttes, so the collective that I spoke about come from that. Yeah, there is no another more younger people, because personally I'm 44 now, so I'm not so young, but there is so all the generation. There is also Alex Jordan that was part of Grapus that is with us also. And there is also some students, and so more recently, 2 weeks ago, I was contacted by another graphic designer that is also an activist that was in link with some young activists about Palestine and the actual mobilization. So now, some just a few days ago, we launched another category in the website of Forme des Luttes to keep together interesting posters to support Gaza, to support the Palestinians against to call about the shame of these mass murders, and we continue now. We keep receiving some new pictures, and like the other cause, everybody can download the pictures, print them, and we will, I hope, soon, we will print some big posters and stick them in the street of Paris.
Dans les contextes parisiens, juste sur ce point-là, de les process de visualiser les mouvements sociaux ou parler de la dynamique de les mouvements sociaux, moi, juste mentionner ça parce que avant, j'ai dit en anglais, ben, beaucoup de célébrations sur les travails de les artistes dans les autres générations pour parler de les luttes sociales collectives, ben, je pense que c'est un point important pour adresser cette force par les institutions ici en France pour assurer tout ça s'est passé dans l'histoire. C'est pas actif dans le moment. C'est possible pour parler un peu de cette dynamique et l'importance d'adresser cette dynamique.
Tu veux que je réponde en français,
oui,
cette fois?
C'est ça. Ok. Oui. Alors moi, je suis pas non plus dans. Enfin, je pense à la fois. Je pense que c'est important qu'il y ait des gens qui préservent les héritages culturels et entre autres l'héritage des formes d'art politique. Et moi-même, on est en contact avec des gens qui sont dans la conservation à la Bibliothèque nationale de France, la BNF, à la Contemporaine, qui créent des expos intéressantes. Et en même temps, effectivement, il faut pas se contenter de regarder le passé et de muséifier le passé. Le passé, c'est aussi, enfin, c'est aussi un bien commun de réflexion, de signes, de formes qui sont, et puis de pratiques qui peuvent être des inspirations pour aujourd'hui. Alors, sans refaire ce qui a été fait autrefois, en étant aussi des points d'appui. Et comme je l'ai dit, voilà, justement, les rencontres avec certains des grands prédécesseurs que nous-mêmes on a rencontrés, qui nous ont participé à nous former et qui vont participer aussi à nous former, y compris dans les actions, pas simplement produire des images, mais aussi justement les faire exister dans un contexte public, dans un contexte de lutte. C'est important. Donc il faut il faut pas muséifier le passé, mais ça veut pas dire non plus qu'il faut les institutions ont leur importance mais c'est comme dans l'art en général ou dans toutes les pratiques, les productions passées, les luttes passées, les recherches passées, elles doivent être remises en action à l'heure présente, et elles doivent pas être simplement des objets de contemplation, mais aussi des outils pour créer des nouvelles choses et produire et diffuser de nouvelles choses.
Mais aussi, juste pour mentionner ce contexte maintenant, parce que c'est un moment vraiment intense à Paris. Dans les dernières semaines, les polices font beaucoup de répression contre les gens qui juste manifestaient pour les droits humains. Et dans ce contexte, les droits humains en Palestine spécifiquement, et dans ce contexte, c'est possible de parler de l'importance de visualiser ou confirmer des choses les gens disent dans les rues, parce que maintenant c'est intense. C'est la première fois de beaucoup des dizaines d'années les polices font les répressions comme ça contre les manifs pour la Palestine.
J'ai jamais connu ça en France depuis. Ça remonte à plusieurs années là maintenant. C'est pas seulement sur la Palestine, mais moi depuis 25 ans que je suis militant, que j'ai milité dans différentes structures. j'aurais jamais imaginé qu'on ait ce niveau de répression des mobilisations en France. Et donc ça remonte, ça a commencé déjà sous le prédécesseur de Macron qui est Hollande, où déjà des manifestations avaient commencé à être interdites et tout, ce qui était vraiment nouveau ici. Enfin, c'était très rare qu'une manifestation soit interdite. Il fallait vraiment des raisons particulières et tout. Et là, maintenant, et puis on a connu le summum, c'était pendant les mobilisations des Gilets jaunes, où on a eu des gens mutilés par des flashballs, donc avec qui perdaient des mains, qui perdaient des yeux. Et ça, c'est inédit. C'est le niveau de violence, c'est vraiment inouï. Et finalement, on finit par s'y habituer. Et donc là, finalement, on n'a pas été si surpris quand ils ont interdit ces manifs sur la Palestine, même si c'est extrêmement révoltant et qu'on est un des seuls pays au monde à les interdire. Alors, celle de samedi dernier était à nouveau interdite. Moi, je pensais que c'était fini parce que le samedi d'avant, ça avait été autorisé. J'ai pu, moi, aller manifester tranquillement et il y a eu, bien évidemment, aucun débordement, parce que c'est ce qui crée les débordements, c'est cette répression-là, c'est d'avoir ça. Les flics qui interdisent, qui sont là. Et donc voilà, donc c'est à la fois terrible de voir le sort terrible qui est fait aux Palestiniens, aux Gazaouis. C'est vraiment incroyable de se dire qu'on peut, on est privé de parole pour simplement de pouvoir dénoncer ça, quoi. Voilà, s'indigner d'un massacre en cours, appeler simplement à ce que cesse le massacre, et puis à traiter les causes profondes, c'est-à-dire à enfin que les Palestiniens, que les Gazaouis retrouvent leurs droits et la possibilité d'avoir des droits de citoyens, quelle que soit la solution, un État, deux États, plusieurs, je sais pas, mais en tout cas, voilà, on a une population qui depuis 1948 est privée de tout droit de citoyenneté, qui vit sous occupation militaire, qui n'a pas de droit. Qui est soumis constamment à l'arbitraire d'un État, à l'arbitraire de l'armée, qui peut se retrouver en prison pour la moindre chose sans avoir droit à la défense. C'est des tas d'enfants qui sont en prison. Et c'est donc Gaza qui est sous blocus depuis 17 ans et là, donc le blocus atteint un niveau, enfin, incroyable, qui est vraiment criminel, où on les prive à la fois d'eau, de nourriture, d'électricité. Et pour en plus aller voilà mener des bombardements aveugles qui tuent des milliers de civils, dont des milliers d'enfants. Et voilà, il faut pouvoir au moins dénoncer ça. Et voilà, dénoncer ça, c'est pas soutenir ce qu'a fait le Hamas, c'est pas soutenir le Hamas, c'est soutenir les droits des Gazaouis à une vie digne, comme tout citoyen de la planète y a droit.
Juste une dernière chose, parce que dans les gauches, ben, en quotation en général en France, beaucoup de gens disent « Oh, non, c'est pas possible pour mobiliser en solidarité avec les Palestiniens pour beaucoup de raisons. » Ben, c'est possible pour parler de l'importance d'adresser cette dynamique, parce que...
Oui. Mais je crois que, justement, alors... une des difficultés, alors bon, il faudrait remonter sur tout l'historique de ce conflit, effectivement, qui est complexe parce que c'est à la fois une situation coloniale et c'est en même temps l'héritage de violences inédites dans l'histoire de l'humanité qui ont touché les populations juives d'Europe, et évidemment le moment le plus terrible et le plus inouï a été le génocide des Juifs pendant la Seconde Guerre mondiale. Mais quelque part, là-dedans, cette responsabilité de ce génocide, elle est entièrement européenne, elle est du côté de l'Europe, et les Palestiniens se retrouvent à payer le prix d'un crime dans lequel ils n'ont aucune responsabilité, et avec le soutien, quelque part, voilà, de pays occidentaux qui eux, ont une part de responsabilité là-dedans. Et donc, voilà, il faudrait... Et donc, ça rend aussi le discours sur ce sujet-là délicat, du fait qu'il faut... du fait qu'il y a cette mémoire qui est évidemment essentielle du génocide des Juifs pendant la Seconde Guerre mondiale, est constamment instrumentalisée pour minimiser, voire condamner les paroles, les actes de soutien aux droits des Palestiniens. Alors que voilà, ça n'a, il faut absolument décorréler ces deux choses-là. Et justement, les gens qui défendent la politique israélienne travaillent eux constamment au contraire, à faire ce genre d'amalgame. Voilà, on a certaines instances en France qui veulent faire croire que l'essentiel des gens se reconnaissant comme juifs ici en France soutiennent nécessairement Israël, et s'ils soutiennent Israël, soutiennent nécessairement Netanyahou. Et ce qui est aujourd'hui, il faut bien le reconnaître, un gouvernement d'extrême droite, ce gouvernement Netanyahou, maintenant il est en affinité, en échange avec beaucoup de gouvernements d'extrême droite en Europe et dans le monde, qui justement, eux, sont des vrais héritiers, des vrais antisémites, et qui arrivent à se donner en soutenant Israël, finalement, eux, ça leur va bien, parce qu'ils soutiennent finalement une forme de colonialisme qui est dans leur vision historique des choses. Mais ça leur permet en même temps d'alimenter et d'entrer en résonance avec des discours anti-arabes ou anti-musulmans qu'on peut avoir notamment ici en France et en Europe, qui ont pas mal monté ces derniers temps. Et donc tout ça, il faut arriver à défaire ces amalgames. Il faut arriver à défendre des principes qui sont universels, des principes qui sont le droit de tous à l'existence, à une vie digne, etc., et à ne pas vivre sous l'oppression d'un gouvernement, d'une armée, etc., qui vous prive de vos droits. Et voilà, c'est une chose simple. Et en même temps, il faut aussi lutter contre toutes les formes de discrimination, de discours racistes, etc., donc, y compris que ce soit contre les Juifs, contre les musulmans, contre les Arabes, contre les Noirs, etc. Voilà, tout ça.
That was a conversation with graphic designer and social activist Sébastien Marchal. You can find more information about the project that he works on at filmdelutte.org, and I will share that link within our archive. You can find that at soundcloud.com/freecityradio. Thank you for listening to another edition of Free City Radio. I'm Stefan Christoph. We air a new program every week and broadcast on a number of stations in Canada. We air Wednesdays on CKUT 90.3 FM at 11 a.m. in Montreal, on CJLO 1690 a.m., also in Geauguagé, Montreal, on Wednesdays at 8:30 a.m., on CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg at 10:30 p.m. on Tuesdays, on CFRC 101.9 FM in Kingston, Ontario, at 11:30 a.m. on Wednesdays, on CFUV 101.9 FM in Victoria, B.C., on Wednesdays at 9 a.m. and Saturdays at 7 a.m., on Met Radio 1280 a.m. in Toronto at 5:30 a.m. on Fridays, and now on CKCU 93.1 FM in Ottawa on Tuesdays at 2 p.m. Again, you can find our archives at soundcloud.com/freecityradio. We are also a podcast. Look us up. We can be found on Spotify and Apple Podcasts. Thanks so much for tuning in, and I will speak to you next week. Take care.
especially in North America, defining one's personal identity is a major life concern. Today on Wings, you'll hear from two millennial women in Canada who identify as witches. They talk about that in relation to family histories and contemporary expression.
There's a river of birds in migration, a nation of women with wings. There's
Welcome to Wings, a series of news and current affairs programs by and about women around the world, produced and distributed by the Women's International News Gathering Service.
Robin Erickson of Campus Community Radio CJSF interviewed two witches for the program Intravenous and Shared with Wings. Both guests were featured in a 2023 Canadian documentary titled Coven, available free on CBC Gem. Here's sound from the film.
Giving women power is a thing where it's just like cultures don't want to do it. Praying for me is a spell. Burning candles in the church is a spell. They just don't call it that. And it's men at the helm, so it's like, it's okay because they're doing it. But if it was a woman, it would be a completely different thing.
The term witch has really gone through a transformation, whereas before it could be a death sentence if you were called that. There has been a movement to reclaim it as something to be proud of.
Here's Robin Erickson interviewing Laura Hogstad and Andra Zlatescu.
I want to ask you both individually, what brought you to the craft and how would you personally describe witchcraft?
For me, it was definitely being raised with my grandmother and also my father's stories. And a lot of them were folklore, a lot of them were fairy tales, but at the root of them was this worldview that everything is sacred, everything is alive, magic is everywhere. So I had the luck and honor and privilege to never have to be raised out of those beliefs. I never had to dissociate from that magical way of thinking and then come back to it and reestablish it. It's always been a part of me.
Andra is a Romanian musician, performer, illustrator, and tarot reader, passionate about creation that serves to act as a spell to open the doorways, honoring the land, their ancestors, and traditions. She plays and sings saw and guitar in the band Willow Switch and loves to create haunting, ethereal folk music. Laura Hogstad is a queer Toronto-based art director, tarot card reader, and the host of the YouTube series on Rue Morgue TV called Terror Tarot, where she analyzes the use of tarot cards in horror films. Laura has always had a strong interest in the occult and magic. And through the use of tarot cards and her solitary practice, Laura searches for a deeper understanding of herself and those around her.
When I was younger and exploring kind of witchcraft on my own, I was just following my instincts. And then later I was like, oh, maybe what I'm doing is part of this practice. And it's something bigger than just me like running around in the forest, collecting things and doing these little rituals that I didn't even really know I was creating. So I've always felt like witchcraft for me was very like introspective because I was mostly a solitary practitioner. But as I've explored my practice more, it's felt quite a bit more empowering and transgressive almost.
What does witchcraft offer us in our understanding of gender and gender roles and the binary of masculine and feminine?
In the 1960s, when Wicca was becoming really prevalent and a lot of these more ceremonial magical systems were becoming really popular and within the social cultural gaze, binary masculine and feminine roles within magic were such a part of those traditions. And so as a non-binary person, approaching those traditions and entering in dialogue with them, you know, or as a queer person or as someone who carries many different worlds within them and holds them all equally real, equally true, wants them all to have the space to exist and manifest in the world, that becomes a more difficult conversation because I think witchcraft will always also represent kind of the values and the worldview of the people practicing it. So we enter into that dialogue with the older views of like the elders within that community. And also it's our role to challenge those things. And in that way, witchcraft grows with us. But a lot of those limiting beliefs exist everywhere. Even if our mind doesn't believe them, sometimes we carry them within our body and within ourselves and within our worldview and how we approach these alternate spaces or magical discussions or different ways of being. And so continuing to challenge that, I feel, is part of what makes witchcraft really powerful, because it's always been tied to non-normative identities. But I feel like each generation creates space for what would have before been considered non-normative. And so we have to keep pushing against that and pushing against it.
I definitely agree. I think modern witchcraft kind of manifests taking a step out of this like patriarchal mindset or rules or expectations, because it seeks to like empower individuals and their self-expression. But I definitely agree there are traditions and ways of being within witchcraft that have to be questioned and dismantled, like you so eloquently said.
Part of women's power is claiming our capacity to create. But in order to create, we have to carry that duality of destroying what is not serving us in order to have the space for manifesting the world that we dream of. And within our sphere of influence, whether that's a couple of people or a whole community, each of us has the capacity to create the world as we want to see it everywhere, to treat people the way we think everybody should be treating each other, you know, like utopias, really. And I feel like creating those worlds around us makes them inhabitable. And that's actually how we change the future and exercise our magic and exercise our power, because maybe your sphere of influence starts at really, really small. And it's just you and your cat, and you treat your cat with integrity and you treat your cat with grace and you make sure that cat is loved and fed. But I think you start to build those relationships of like alignment with your mind, body, your spirit, your integrity, and then your sphere of influence starts to grow and it starts to grow and it starts to grow. And that's what it means to claim our power.
That's such a nice segue into this next question that I have. There was an article by Anne Theriault called The Real Reason Women Love Witches, which was published in Medium. And she says, sort of tongue in cheek, it's not about broomsticks or cats, it's about power. And you started to talk about this, Andra, but Laura, what does the power look like to you?
I do kind of agree. It is a little bit about cats, just because I have two and I love them. But at the beginning of the article, Anne talks about this girlhood experience I related to. It was going to sleepovers and having this group of young girls together practicing different types of divination, you know, in a childish way, maybe doing like a seance or trying to talk through a Ouija board, all these like sleepover kind of cliches. But I really think young girls and young children or young people are drawn to witches as a source of power, because it's this group of people who really don't feel very empowered at that stage of life. And you're searching for that power and control. And I feel like that kind of follows you into adulthood, at least for myself. I definitely find that ongoing search for personal empowerment through my practice.
I do think it's stepping into your power and not being afraid of what we would consider the more dangerous aspects of power, like anger, for example. Like anger can burn things down. Anger can be a boundary setter. Anger can be a protector. So I think part of witchcraft is learning to claim all aspects of your power, to be comfortable with your shadow aspects, to hold all of those worlds as true and equal, and to ground yourself in all of them. And I see this modern trend that I think we have to be really careful of, you know, which witchcraft is really popular right now. And it's really popular right now also as a form of like edgy consumerism. And what ends up happening is, you know, this movement that's really meant to empower, especially, you know, like you said, Laura, like often young, insecure women at an age where they're learning who they are, can be just as disempowering when what it's doing is saying, you know, I'll sell you a spell or I'll sell you a candle that will like solve your anxiety or solve your depression or like, you know, fix the problems in your life. Because the problem with a lot of traditional religion is it adds an intermediary between you and your truth. And so the only teachers you should follow are the ones that bring you back to your heart. And it's not about buying the right stuff or buying the right tools or looking the right way. we used to live in a world, you know, there's also separation between witchcraft and like animism. Like many of us used to live in a world where everything was sacred, you know, magic was mm-hmm. everywhere. We all honored the land and held those relationships really, really strong within us. And there's absolutely no reason, I feel, to not walk those paths now and to not have those direct experiences with the sacred and what we would consider magic, what we would consider miracles. And so being really, really careful of what intermediaries we put between ourselves and the experience of the sacred. As a tarot reader too, like one of the things I'm always trying to remind people is, you know, you carry your truth with you. If I tell you anything that doesn't resonate with you at all, don't listen to me, because ultimately the only reason I'm able to read these truths is because that person walked through my door already deep somewhere in their spirit, already knowing those things and seeking their own healing and seeking their own growth. Even when you're given those opportunities or you're given power in their life where you can tell them if something's right or wrong, holding that as a deeply ethical thing, always bringing it back to their power and their truth and what feels right to them.
I also read tarot, and I say it's similar things to anyone who comes through for reading. It's like, whatever resonates with you, take that. And I also say, like, tarot isn't going to predict the future or give you lottery numbers or, you know, all these things that people think it will. But what it will do is like help you kind of shine light onto, like you said, Andra, to your own truth and what you kind of already know. It just helps guide you, maybe if you're unsure of that path, but you've got it in here.
On Wings, you're listening to interviews with two women who live in Canada and have found their personal identity as witches. Both of them make use of tarot card readings. Laura Hochstad found a niche in media analyzing and criticizing the use of tarot cards in horror films. Here's a short clip from her debut performance in the podcast series Terror Tarot.
My name's Laura Hochstad. I am an intern here at RumOrg magazine, and I'm also a tarot card reader. I'm a big fan of horror movies, and so I thought today let's look at some tarot moments in some of my favorite horror films. Welcome to Terror Tarot on RumOrg TV. Today we're going to be talking about the movie Dr. Terror's House of Horror. Since this is our first episode, I thought I'd do a little intro on what tarot is. Tarot was originated in the 14th or 15th century, but its true origins are shrouded in mystery. It did not become associated with the occult until the 18th century. The deck that we're going to be using today to look at the film with is Smith & Waite tarot deck. This one's based on the traditional Rider-Waite tarot deck, but it is a little bit different. The first card is the Fool. It does indicate the beginning of a journey. So in that sense, I do find that Dr. Terror is using the card in its correct imagery. The next card is the Magician. And this one typically in tarot indicates that you are in charge of your own journey in your own life, and all the tools you need are in front of you. But what we also see in the imagery of these cards is there's lots of plant life around, especially in the Hanged Man as well. And we see in the Sun card, there's a lot of plant growth in the background. And I believe that's a bit of foreshadowing, because upon arrival, him and his wife notice that there's a lot of weeds have grown up over the house. And when Bill tries to cut them down, the shears fly out of his hand. And what we find out is that this plant is a killer plant, and it's coming to take over Bill's house, to kill him, his wife, and anyone who comes to visit. I find, if I were to give it a pass or fail, this reading fails.
As of March 2024, there are 13 videos in Laura's Terror Tarot series, viewable on YouTube. Now back to Robin Erickson's interview with the two millennial witches.
Erica Feldman is the proprietor of House Witch, which is a shop in Salem, Massachusetts. And she says that for her, the initials WITCH stand for Woman in Total Control of Herself.
It's a funny acronym. And for Erica, as a business owner making this huge empire of House Witch, that acronym definitely resonates. I think I heard her say in an interview too that just even taking back the word witch is kind of like a radical feminist act. And I definitely feel that way as well. But personally, I I don't know if it was self-control that I was really searching for in my journey anyway. It was more like self-acceptance and finding that power within.
Yeah, the idea of control over yourself or over things around you is often this very top-down power, right? It's your mind over matter, your logic often over your emotions or your intuition. And I think it's also part of this really almost like capitalist worldview of each person as this individual subject, you know, separate from community, separate from the land, separate from the bigger waves of energy or experience that a lot of us tend to share. And I think trying to control things is often a fear-based response. And the harder thing is accepting and allowing yourself to be a part of all of these beautiful relationships that we find ourselves in.
The beautiful thing about witchcraft as a whole is that there's so many different avenues that you can go down looking for mentors and finding community and a connectedness.
Yeah, and the only teachers you should follow are the ones that guide you back to your heart.
What has been your experience of the process of stepping into this self-identification?
The most resistance I actually have ever gotten is from my own family. They have a very traditional worldview of a lot of these things and a lot of negative associations. I've been moving through my life and through the world as a witch and identifying in that way for a long time, but I tend to not invite people into those vulnerable aspects of myself unless I know that they can honor them. You know, my mother told me I'm not a witch and what am I doing? And then after being invited into those spaces, I think she understood better what witchcraft means and was actually really proud of me. And it was really sweet that she gained a broader understanding of that. But I think it was difficult to navigate.
It was almost easier for me to tell people I was a witch than to come out as gay. My family and friends jokingly referred to me as a witch. And when I was in high school, there was a rumor that went around that I was a witch and a lesbian. And it turned out that both were true. I hate that the bullies were right. But it was almost like when I started to really own my identity as a witch, it was almost like a little bit of a soft launch of my queer identity. It's like, okay, so I'll say I'm a witch and who accepts me for that? Who is okay with it? And okay, well, now maybe I can take that next step and reveal another part of who I am.
My family has informed my belief system and my practice, but it's one of those things where the moment you speak it, it becomes dangerous. And in the case of my family, they were revolutionaries against the oppressive communist regime in Romania. So they were raised that the way you keep yourself safe is you don't speak your opinion, you don't speak your truth, you hide, you try to be like everybody else. So you may carry these beliefs, but the fact that I'm speaking them, I think brings up a lot of that in them. A lot of those beliefs around like the best way to protect our children and keep them safe is to make sure that they're also hiding in those ways so they're not in danger. But I keep myself safe by not holding things inside my body and learning to speak my truth so that it doesn't burn me up.
Laura, I'm curious about your perspective on this because there's ancestral history for you there. You discovered that you're related to a couple of witches who have been hung and that we carry this cellular ancestral somatic knowing about things.
Yeah, absolutely. That was like a shock to the system when we discovered that I not only had one ancestor in Salem who was persecuted as a witch, but then to find out also if I trace my family back in Scotland that that same thing had happened. It was shocking. It made me angry because when we think about the witch trials that were going on all over Europe and America, you know, between 14 to 1700s, I think I read somewhere that it was like 40 to 50,000 people during that time were killed for that. You do carry that with you. I think you carry your ancestors' energies and their memories are kind of like a ripple in your mind. I had a profound experience of doing a past life regression where I didn't know what was going to happen, but then to really feel like I tapped into those feelings of the ancestors and how they were feeling at that time. It was really profound and sad and scary, but also kind of, you know, there was a part where it's like, okay, so I've always been feeling this way, to trace that lineage back to feel like, okay, so that it's for a reason, you know, there's something there that really made me connect to it, because I was always, I think, we're our harshest critic. I was like, oh, I don't have any space in this world. I don't deserve to be here. I'm not, you know, what I imagine I should be to be able to say that I'm a witch. But that part, as hard as it was a bit validating, I guess, in a sad way, I guess.
Similar to what Laura was saying, that we carry our own truth and we carry our knowledge and we carry our ancestry, and it lives in our bodies. So even if we're not within our mind, logically, rationally aware of where those messages or feelings come from, so often your instinct remembers. And biologically, we're made of our ancestors. Ancestral memory is part of what informs us. And so we have access to this knowledge, even if our head may not know it. We're still responding from not just our environment that formed us, but things much, much older than that. I keep saying this, but the only teachers that should guide you are the ones that bring you back to your own truth. I went to Romania and I met this beautiful family of witches. They practice traditionally. They're actually the only Romani clan where the women are the ones who work predominantly, and they work as witches, and they work in witchcraft, and they do rituals, they do spells, they do palm readings, you know, blessings, curses, all of that. And they don't actually believe that there is good or bad magic. They believe that you should be able to do all of it, but then you can choose what you do. You know, you decide your path by making those choices of what you're willing to practice and not practice when other people come and make those asks for you. And so to be really unexpectedly actually initiated into their coven and brought into working with them, and to get to see and experience a lot of these things firsthand, I think what it also really taught me is that, you know, I'm my own worst critic. I'm the one with the biggest imposter syndrome, and the people like outside of me don't see that. And even after they were all like so validating, and they were so like, oh no, you're here because you're supposed to be here, because it's ancestral, because clearly the universe brought you here. You know, I'm the one who's like still carrying all of these doubts and feelings. And so going back to like in the tarot, you know, there's the devil card, and the devil is hell is our own creation, and we're responsible for the chains that bind us. You know, you can like go to the ends of the world and have like other people like sing your praises or validate you or like include you in the heart of their community and like meet you with trust and welcoming and these beautiful things. And you can still like carry those same old beliefs around yourself. And so, you know, the alchemical change, the witchcraft, the magic and all of that is like actually slowly, slowly like growing and healing those belief systems we carry within us that limit our own power and our own capacity to like share our gifts with the world and with our communities in reciprocity of honoring other people's gifts and becoming stronger in that way.
I completely agree, especially when we talk about this like imposter syndrome. For me, when I got to go through and do that ceremony with one of the high priestesses, it was an overwhelming experience. It was not anything I ever expected to do, but it was really, it was wonderful to see how they do their practice. And then, you know, to be able to meet other practitioners and to be able to connect with like Andra as well and talk about that it doesn't have to be this one specific way of practicing was really helpful for me. To know, you know, the way that I've felt connected to nature and the way that I've practiced, there are other folks who do it that way as well. So that was just validating. And then again, going back to finding this heritage within my family of people who had been accused of witchcraft, it was just, it was a connectedness to the past and to my practice. And it just like brought everything kind of all together and made me feel a lot more confident in holding that identity in that space.
So much of what we think about ourselves and the past is deeply rooted in white male cisgendered myth and white supremacy. How do you see the ways that witchcraft seeks to interrupt this and reframe outdated notions of who we are and who we can be?
Just if we think, just going back to the witch trials as well, and how that basically stems from men's fear of women in power and wanting to control women. Honestly, the people who were accused of witchcraft during all that time were healers. They were leaders in their community. They were women who possibly spoke up. Or what I learn is a woman may have had property that a man wanted. So I think it's just like that lobbing of that word and using it in this way, you know, I feel like men throughout history have done that to try and disempower women. There's something that they fear there. And I think it is women coming together, being in their power and just, you know, existing in this way. So I think that witchcraft in itself is trying to disrupt that kind of patriarchal view of who's in power and who isn't.
And I feel like, you know, like a lot of spiritual traditions, and even modern spiritual traditions, and also like the media, too, it's a lot of escapism. It's a lot of, you know, transcending your present moment, like leaving your body, you know. And for me, it was always like, well, I don't need help dissociating. I do that really easily. You know, I want my spiritual practice to be something that helps bring me into my bones and bring me into the present. For me, it's also recognizing how deeply my body is rooted in relationship to the land. The less you are dependent on other people. You know, you can be part of community, you can share of your gifts, but you are whole and complete unto yourself. You know, you don't need like a man or whatever to validate your existence. And I think that's also why witchcraft is so threatening.
And it's like, going back to the accusations that were thrown at women too. I was reading that, you know, if you're an old woman and you're unmarried, oh, then you could get this accusation of witchcraft. And but at the same time, if you were a young girl who was attractive and like, you know, the man felt like you were casting a spell on them, you know, it's just like all these things that, you know, it was at that time, the result would be hanging in this accusation of witchcraft. But very much so, those ideas are still there today. It's like, oh, an unmarried older woman is, you know, just thrown away kind of in the way that society, especially patriarchal society, regards them, and young women as well, seen as this like temptress, when it's like, no, maybe they're just existing and you guys just need to stop being so creepy about it.
That was Robin Erickson's interview with Laura Hochstad and Andres Latescu. Laura Hochstad hosts a series called Terror Tarot on YouTube. Andres Latescu is a musician who plays guitar and saw and sings in the two-person band Willow Switch. Wings purchased from Bandcamp the Willow Switch song Baba Yaga, in which Andres sings about the fabled Slavic witch whose house walked about on chicken's legs and who was rumored to eat children. Here's an excerpt. Wings thanks Robin Erickson, CJSF Radio, and the program IntraVenus for the interview with Canadian witches Laura Hochstad and Andres Latescu. You can see them both in the documentary Coven on CBC's video service Gem. Thanks also to all Wings supporters, including your community radio stations, Suzette Cullen and Genevieve Vaughn, whose events can be found through the website maternalgifteconomymovement.org. That's all one word, maternalgifteconomymovement.org. The Wings sound logo is from Libana's album A Circle Is Cast. I'm Wings series producer.
Hello, it's me, Eve. Yeah, that's right. This is Question Mark of Question Mark and the Mysterians, and you are listening to CKUT.
Yeah, all night long, a 96 year. Cry, cry, cry. Come on, baby, let me hear you cry now. All night long, a 96.
Prison Radio on CKUT 90.3 FM in Montreal on www.ckut.ca on the World Wide Web. News, interviews, and music featuring the voices of prisoners, their allies, and supporters. Tune in to the Prison Radio Show every other week on Tuesdays between 6 and 7 p.m. to get involved with Prison Radio, or if you need to access past programs, email prison@ckut.ca.
Yes, rehabilitation.
I wonder if you know what the word means.
Do you?
It comes from the Latin root habilis. The definition is to invest again with dignity. You consider that part of your job, Harvey, to give a man back the dignity he once had? Your only interest is in how he behaves. You'll conform to our ideas of how you should behave.
I am not a number. I am a free man.
You were a number. You weren't a man. You want to be a human. I wasn't Jim Crow. And hell, I was number 586.